It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Ku Klux Klan is something that most of us think of as being a Southern problem. But in the early 1920s, a number of KKK chapters came to being in Iowa. This hour, we'll talk about the history of the Klan in our state, and later in the hour, race relations in Iowa today. My first guests are historians who'll be giving a lecture on Saturday at the Mason City Public Library at 2 p.m. about the history of the KKK in Northern Iowa and Minnesota. Terry Harrison is an archivist and historian at the Mason City Public Library. Hello, Terry.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Elizabeth Dorsey Hatley is the author of The Ku Klux Klan in Minnesota. She also grew up in Mason City. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And a few months ago on Talk of Iowa, we talked about the history of the Ku Klux Klan in Centerville, Iowa, around the turn of the century, and the presence of the Klan in southern Iowa, so close to Missouri, a former slave state. I think that's not as difficult for people to comprehend. But northern Iowa, Mason City, Minnesota, that seems to be so far away from that conflict. When did this start?
In the state of Minnesota, first documented activity was in 1920, early in 1920. And it was, it seemed to originate out of Minneapolis and then spread throughout the state.
And 1920, you've pointed out that this is a period post-World War I. Things were changing dramatically. Elizabeth, what was going on that sort of created this fertile ground?
Well, we had an immigrant population that was increasing, so we had a lot of different groups that were coming in with different cultures and different religions. And in Minnesota's particular situation, the Catholic population was increasing, and that was causing some discomfort.
And the racial makeup of Minnesota and northern Iowa at that time was not something that most people would consider to be diverse.
No, at least in Minnesota, it was largely Scandinavian. The first two immigrant groups that were here in the state were the Norwegians and the Swedish population. But then after World War I, of course, there was a strong reaction against the Germans, immigrants, and that was what was occurring in Minnesota.
And, Terry, there was an episode in Mason City in the early 1920s that seems to be the first bit of KKK activity in that area. Can you tell me what happened?
A socialist lecturer named Ida Crouch Hazlett was giving a speech in August 1921 in Central Park in the middle of town, and apparently a large group of people that were apparently American Legionnaires. They were backed up by a Salvation Army band, and the band drowned her talking out, and then the Legionnaires grabbed her and kidnapped her and dropped her off, as far as I can tell, in Nora Springs, 10 miles east of here. Well, she got back. Some farmers gave her a ride back to town. She wasn't harmed, and the next night she was speaking in Waterloo. But the next day or so, the individuals that had taken her claimed that they were wanting to apply for a charter from the Grand Wilderness of Georgia because they didn't want to, act under the auspices of, for instance, the American Legion or any other group, and they thought that joining the Klan would be the best way, and they defined themselves as there will be other occasions of the sort and where former servicemen leagued with non-servicemen may wish to aid the government and society and not do so in the name of the Legion or other organization. So they decided the Klan would be the best organization to join for that. So that was 1921.
So it sounds like this was a political response.
Yeah, I think so. Social and political response. You know, the Palmer raids. Mitchell Palmer was attorney general, and he was the whole Red Scare was beginning about that time. It was post-World War I, and as Liz has said, there was a lot of anti-immigrant feeling, and there was a lot of feeling that the immigrants were socialists, or Reds, as they called them, the communist element might be in, you know, coming into the country. And Mason City, second only to Clinton, Iowa, for the number of immigrants living here. So,
well, and Elizabeth, obviously it wasn't all political. In Minnesota, there is even a history of lynchings that took place in Duluth.
Right, and that happened in June of 1920. And right after that, within less than a year, Duluth organized its own Klan chapter and would meet. Their meeting hall was less than three blocks from the jail where the three young men were dragged out and lynched.
And when did that happen?
June 15th, 1920, when the three young men were lynched. And then, like I said, within a year, Duluth had organized its own Klan chapter, which to me doesn't seem like the correct response to organize a Klan chapter after you have a lynching like that. And in Duluth's particular situation, I was provided the Duluth Klan member lists from 1925 and 1926, and half of the members tracking them down were World War One veterans.
Were there other incidents of violence that you uncovered in your research?
Not after what happened in Duluth. I mean, after Duluth, for the next 10 years in Minnesota, it was the typical Klan type of activity, the burning of crosses on people's front yards, running certain groups out of town, that type of thing.
The Ku Klux Klan had a rule that if you were a child of immigrants, then you weren't eligible for membership, which seems to be problematic in this part of the country because everyone had recently immigrated. How did Klan membership work around that issue?
They came up, a man from Indiana named Robert Lyons came up with a naturalization ceremony. And what they would do is to bring in members whose parents were immigrants, they would go through this naturalization rite, and then that's how they could join the Klan. I mean, it's also getting new bodies and new money coming in, too, as you pointed out, because of the fact that we had immigrants and a lot of children of immigrants.
So, Terry, in your research, when did you first come across Klan activity in Mason City?
Probably not long after I moved to Mason City. I moved here 22 years ago from Missouri. And I was aware because you study American history, you're aware that the Klan had moved by the 1920s into the upper Midwest. So it didn't really shock me one day when I was looking through some newspaper articles when I ran across an article saying that the Klan would be at the fairgrounds, North Iowa fairgrounds. And then I started looking into that and repeatedly for about 6 years there, I found articles off and on where the Klan would be meeting at the Highlands area, which we have a Highland golf course now. But that area of northeastern Mason City was apparently the big meeting ground for the Klan. And so I started getting into these and rather elaborate parades, elaborate meetings. When I would bring this up locally, of course, people were pretty astounded, and I would ask about it, and no one seemed to know that there was ever any Klan around here until when I pointed it out in the newspaper. It became kind of an interesting thing, I think, for most of them.
And how large do you think the Klan was in the Mason City area?
You know, the largest estimate we have is around 200 people, and so it must have been fairly large because there were. At one point, 1924, there was a large meeting in the Highlands area having around 4,000 Klansmen. And on the second day of their big meeting, we had a commission form of government at the time with three commissioners ran the city government. And E.J. Patton, one of the commissioners, actually led a Klan parade with 634 people down Federal Avenue. The next year, in 1925, it seemed to be even a larger meeting at the North Iowa Fairgrounds. At that time, North Iowa Fairgrounds were on South Federal. And large six-day circuses with vaudeville acts and even a lady prize fighter fighting Furpo, who was a well-known prize fighter, heavyweight champion, you know. So exhibition bouts, Klan baby contests. And they did this repeatedly from 24, 25, and 26, we see large meetings in Mason City. So there must have been a pretty active group. I don't think they ever gained very much political control here. I do have one article where they actually lost an election for city school secretary election or a school treasurer's election, the Klan ballot lost in Mason City by resoundingly defeated. So I don't think they were that. You know, there were a lot of them, but generally speaking, I'm not sure that the population really got into what they were doing.
And from your research, how long did this phenomenon last?
The last meeting that we know of for sure that was a large meeting was 1926. Now, I haven't run into any others after that, but it probably was. And Liz would probably be able to expound on this more. I think it was in 1926 when one of the large national leaders got in serious trouble in Indiana and ended up in jail for manslaughter charges, sodomy, rape, everything else. And I think that probably put a damper on some of the Klan activity, although I do have a Klan certificate locally here that shows that an individual joined the local Betsy Ross Klan number 7.
And Elizabeth mentioned getting her hands on the membership of the Duluth Klan. Do you have a list of membership?
No, I don't. we don't have one here. They're not owing up to it so far. So,
there's probably one out there somewhere,
too. I bet there is, but they're not putting it out and whatever.
But you have had people, and we'll talk more about this in a moment because we need to take a short break, but you've both had people come forward and say, hey, I discovered this in my family's past,
and
share artifacts with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, we'll talk more in just a moment. Right now we're talking about the history of the Ku Klux Klan in North Iowa and in Minnesota. If this is a part of your family's history and you have a story that you're willing to share, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me right now, Terry Harrison, archivist and historian with the Mason City Public Library, and also Elizabeth Dorsey Hatley. She is the author of The Ku Klux Klan in Minnesota. They will be giving a lecture on Saturday at the Mason City Public Library at 2 p.m. about the history of the KKK in Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the history of the Ku Klux Klan in North Iowa and in Minnesota, a history that mainly focuses on the 1920s. I have two historians with me right now. Later in the hour, we'll be talking about race relations in the state today. With me is Elizabeth Dorsey Hatley. She is the author of The Ku Klux Klan in Minnesota. Terry Harrison is also here. He's an archivist and historian at the Mason City Public Library. And on Saturday at 2 p.m. at the Mason City Public Library, they will be giving a public lecture about the history of the KKK in North Iowa. And Elizabeth, Terry was just saying that the latest evidence he has of someone being inducted into the Ku Klux Klan in Mason City is 1926. In Minnesota, this organization lasted longer, didn't it?
Yes. Unfortunately, we went all the way to 1930. And the mayor of St. James, Minnesota, was elected Grand Dragon of the Midwest for the Dakota states, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota. And there was a large gathering in St. Paul. And he, as I said, unfortunately, we didn't get out until 1930. And Dave Stevenson, the one who was arrested for manslaughter and convicted, who was a Grand Dragon of Indiana, came to Robbinsdale, Minnesota, and violated his parole and hid out in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. And he was arrested and taken back to Indiana, and that was in 1950.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So with the since you know a little bit more about the individuals involved in these different Klan chapters in Minnesota, it sounds like a lot of people in political office and in power were involved.
Yes, that was one of the reasons I bumped into Iowa. Stafford King, who was Minnesota's state auditor for 30 years, I documented and verified he belonged to the KKK. Found his membership card in his papers at the Minnesota Historical Society, and he was close friends with Hanford McNider from Mason City.
And who was Hanford McNider?
He was a businessman, and he also worked, or he was a Secretary of War, and he ran the bank in Mason City, and he also ran the cement, Northwestern State's Portland Cement Company in Mason City.
So with all of these connections and the research that you've done, Terry, you mentioned that the people, when you started asking about it, people said, no, we have no recollection of that. And this is something that a lot of people are ashamed of, and I can imagine forgetting pretty easily if they had known. Did you start to have people come forward and say, no, I do know that my family was involved in this?
I had a rather, we actually possess a robe and hood. That was an original robe and hood from a Klansman here. And in the last 9 months or so, I found out actually who owned it. And the lady whose family owned it will probably be in to talk to Liz on Saturday and be here. So she's got quite the story on it. And so
can,
she'll
can
be,
you give us a little bit of insight
apparently,
into that story?
Apparently, she would have been really pretty young, not very old at all, and the story goes that her father went out with his friends one evening, and when he came back, he had this robe and membership, and her mother just said, well, that's the last time you're going to ever wear that thing, and that was pretty much the end of that. And so it's kind of an interesting story. The other item that I have is a silk sash with says Order of the White Camellia embroidered on it, you know, or the White Camellia, the rose embroidered on it. And that came by way of another individual along with their certificate from 1926. Now, that was brought to me by an individual probably 15 years ago now. I'd have to look on the accession number on it. And the lady that brought it to me had no actual connection to it. She was just cleaning out her attic and found it in a box.
So,
she had no knowledge
of it.
No, she just thought, well, look at this.
It made it to her attic somehow.
Yep, it was probably the people who owned the house before. She lived over on the northwest side, I believe. And so she, you know, it was the older houses over there, and she was cleaning out the attic, and there it was.
Well, Elizabeth, how about you? Have you had people come forward with artifacts that they discovered?
The same thing, where they find things, and maybe the attic's a popular place. I recently had a woman who contacted me, and she now lives up in northern Minnesota, and they found her grandfather and her great uncle's robes and hoods. And her family actually was from Sheldon, Iowa, and they found these items in Sheldon, Iowa. So she contacted me to see if I had come across her family name up here in Minnesota, and I had not come across it in Minnesota, but the items, like I said, were found in Sheldon, Iowa. And the family did acknowledge the fact that the grandfather and the great uncle did belong to that clan chapter in that area.
Have you had people who find these artifacts that are stunned to learn that their family was involved?
Somebody else contacted me, and they were a little bit shocked. But at the same time, when they found the articles and they looked back at some of the family history and how people had acted in the family, it sort of made sense in terms of where they were. For an example, a family member had married a Catholic, and they would have nothing more to do with that family member. And that was in the 50s and 60s. So social bias that occurred in the 1920s still occurs today. And I think some of these families, maybe it would put more context to their family history if they understand what their families were doing back then and how they thought back then. Especially if they were in the Klan.
We have an email from Kristen that says, my great-grandfather was a member of the KKK in Eagle Grove during the 1920s. It has been handed down to us later generations from the oral history of our family. He joined the KKK because of his dislike and prejudice of the Catholic faith. Unfortunately, we do know that he did participate in cross burnings on the front lawns of Catholic people there in Eagle Grove. This prejudice of the Catholics was probably due to his father-in-law who emigrated from northern Iowa before the Civil War. He was a Protestant. Interestingly, they came to Iowa from Indiana, where it sounds like there was a large KKK presence. And as you explore this history, it didn't last very long in Mason City. from the early 1920s till about 1926. Why is it important to explore this history, Terry?
Well, I think any time you should look at all of the history of a community. We are a local history project here, and so it's necessary to look at all of the history of I think, any area you're in, whether it's a nice history or not. Mason City, of course, has got a wonderful history of architecture, of music, of those things. And if you only remember those wonderful things, you get a rather distorted picture. I've told people before that, you know, if you only remember the good things in your past, and if you only see the bad in your present, then you'll soon despair, won't you, of your present. You should really remember that things in the past were not always really, really nice. Alongside all of the great and glorious things, there were really dark and dingy things that are going on at the same time. And you should be able to balance that out and help balance your present society out, too. It'll give you a better, much better perspective.
And it gives some context to people and how their families are, too, if they have some idea what their true family history is, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Ray is on the line in Mason City. Hello, Ray.
Hi. I remember my dad telling me a story that when he was a young boy, his father took he and his youngest sister to a picnic, which ended up being a KK recruitment. And I always remember there was a paint store. My dad was a painting contractor, and there was a paint store that he always hated to buy paint from this guy. But he did once in a while, and he turned... He finally told me why one time, in that he said, at that picnic, this man was one of the head of the Ku Klux Klan. And my grandfather told them on the way home, he says, I could never belong to an organization where I had to hide my face.
Ray, thank you so much for sharing that story.
You're welcome.
Terry, is that a? Have you heard stories from people like Ray about experiences like that, or is that something that a lot of families have kept to themselves?
We've not gotten a lot of stories, but I'm hoping this Saturday meeting and this conversation will bring more and more people out. I think there is a considerably more interest in bringing out these things, certainly, than there was almost 20 years ago. I remember it was about 20 years ago that Franklin County Historical Society had a display on the KKK in Franklin County, and they had contacted some people in Mason City who just simply flat out denied. Some of the historical agencies said, well, there was never any Klan here. When they finally got around to calling me, I said, well, of course there was a Klan here. And and since then, I've included a mention of the Klan in the 20s whenever I go to school visits and that sort of thing. So for many years now, there's always a few of the school kids that are fascinated by this, and they'll do as part of their project, the Klan in Mason City, and what it did. So I think that's brought up more awareness of it. I do know the closest stories that I have to Klan activity and people having anything to do with it come from one person whose family were immigrant families, and a prominent immigrant family here, lived at the Lehigh Row area, and he told me of a story when he was a little kid and in the 20s tried to have a rally out that would be on the northwest side of town by the cement plants and where the immigrant labor all lived. And when the Klan showed up, the local story there is that the immigrant men armed themselves with axe handles and clubs and went out, and there was never any more Klan rallying out by the cement plant. And that has never been in the paper, but that was the story that was handed down. Others of the Klan actually terrorizing Catholic families over by the St. Joseph area, going on the front lawns, and I'm not sure we have any record of them burning a cross, but I'm sure they may have rallied around the church. That was a very large Irish Catholic area in Mason City.
We're talking about the history of the Ku Klux Klan in Iowa, in North Iowa and Minnesota this hour. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tim is on the line next in Anamosa. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Charity. My father was born in Anamosa in 1912, and he related the story of, he said that most of the Klan members in Jones County were hot-headed young German farmers. That was the way he put it. And he said their rumor was that the Catholics were storing munitions in the basement of the local church and were simply waiting for the call from the Pope. But one story he also related was that in the state park at Anamosa, the Wapsipinicon State Park, the Klan held a huge rally in the mid-20s, at least one rally, and one of his uncles was creeping around lifting the handkerchiefs off of the license plates because all the cars were raised and they all looked the same, and he was curious to know who was there, and he looked up at one point and was surrounded by white hoods, and the story goes that they pushed him around a little, threatened that they'd make him, that they'd get him fired from the reformatory where he worked, but apparently nothing happened. And I'm not sure why they were allowed to rally at the state park, but I understand rules were then implemented so that there wouldn't be any more Klan rallies.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for sharing that memory. And we have this one also from Burlington. This is from Randy. He says, my grandfather was a member of the Klan in Burlington some 50 years ago. I don't doubt that he was racist. He died before I was born. However, it is noteworthy that his employer, Burlington Savings Bank, required their employees to join. And of course, we've been focusing on North Iowa and Minnesota. What do we know about Klan activity across the state of Iowa in the 1920s?
I'm sure that, I know there are several historical works out of the old Palimpsest, I believe, and Annals of Iowa that have written, had articles over the past several years of, Klan farmer in northern Iowa and other materials like that. There has been research over the last, 30, 40 years about Klan activity in Iowa across the state.
Cherry is on the line next in Coal Valley, Illinois. Hello, Cherry.
Yes, hi.
Hi, what's your story?
My grandfather, according to family legend, joined the KKK, and he moved from Mason City to Cedar Rapids, so I'm not sure when he did this, but he was Native American and not identifiably so, and the story in the family was that he joined that to keep his ethnic background a secret because he was afraid of the Klan.
Oh, interesting. Cherry, thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
Sure, thank you.
And in your research, Elizabeth, I know that people have come to you with relics, with questions about their family history, and these questions have been started in their minds because of something that has happened today. You mentioned a story of a woman who adopted a biracial child.
And that... Excuse me. And that was the woman whose grandfather and great uncle had belonged to the Klan. And like I said, I think she was trying to put context in what her family was like and what current circumstances are like. And if I could comment on the woman from Indiana whose father came over. And there was a lot of that, too, where I think the naturalization right came up. And joining the Klan, it's kind of hard to understand that today, but it was a political organization. You could meet people. It was a fraternal organization. So you could make business connections. You could increase your status in the community by joining the 1920s Klan.
And Elizabeth, we have just a few seconds left, and I asked Terry this earlier, but why do you feel it's so important for us to know about this history?
Again, it's some of those same social issues that bothered people in the 1920s. Same thing occurring today, anti-immigration, different religions, different cultures, whether you're a true American or not an American. Some of those things still are occurring in our society today. So I think if we have a better understanding of our past, we can take those lessons and apply them today and do a better job.
Thank you so much for being with me today, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Dorsey Hatley is the author of The Ku Klux Klan in Minnesota. Terry Harrison, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Terry Harrison is an archivist and historian at the Mason City Public Library. They will be giving a lecture on Saturday at the Mason City Public Library at 2 p.m. about the history of the KKK in North Iowa and in Minnesota. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to talk about racial relations in Iowa today. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We've been talking about the history of the KKK in Iowa, and most of us would like to think that kind of overt racism is a thing of the past. But is that the case? My next guests will help us explore the race picture in the state today. Arnold Woods is the president of the NAACP Des Moines branch. Hello, Arnold.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here today.
You're so welcome.
And Ben Stone is the executive director of the ACLU of Iowa. Hello, Ben.
Good morning, Charity. Good to be with you.
Yeah, thank you for being here today. And Arnold, let's start with you. Iowa is a more diverse state than it used to be, although still does not rank high in with diversity numbers compared to many other states in the union. In looking at our diversity picture in the state today and some of the conflicts that do arise, what is your overall view of racial relations in Iowa today?
Well, I would certainly suggest that we still have both overt and under-the-table racism in our state and in our nation. And certainly life is better today than it was in the 20s. There's no doubt about that. But we can still point to issues, some great things happening in Iowa, as well as some things that we would like to see changed.
Well, and let's point to the things that we would like to see changed in the state. Let's focus on the negative, at least to start off this hour. And Ben, maybe you can start us with that. What do you think the biggest problem is with racial relations in Iowa today?
Well, I think that there are so many things that we have seen documented by social scientists and by researchers. The school-to-prison pipeline, where kids of color in schools find themselves in the criminal justice system at a far, far greater rate, and the ramifications of that. We've also got the problem of racial profiling, people being pulled over because of the color of their skin, and the real denial of that as a problem, and really the way that that denial affects the relationship between institutions of power and the people that are affected directly by that. The war on drugs certainly has had a absolutely devastating impact on communities of color, both in Iowa and around the country. The rate of incarceration is just astronomical. You know, 1 in 12 African Americans in Iowa. At some point, there was a study that showed that. I'm not sure what it is currently, but there's just so many different ways we can see that there are major problems. But I do want to kind of point out that, you know, the what we just listened to for the last 40 minutes is that, you know, the Klan is really about going after people who are different, whether it's religious, whether it's race, whether it's gender. And I think that same attitude is reflected in a lot of the politics we see today when it comes to the GLBT community and issues around immigration and, of course, religion. There's a lot of religious activity that is very controversial, and the role of government and the role of all of that. So, you know, the things that made the Klan rise up in the 1920s, those underlying cultural and other issues are still lurking here in Iowa and around the country.
Let's focus on what you're calling the school-to-prison pipeline. And for people who aren't aware of this phenomenon, explain what you mean by that.
Well, it's basically, I mean, without spending a whole lot of time on it, we don't have a lot of time. It's the aspect that when, you know, it used to be that when a kid got in trouble at school, it was pretty much a school issue. You know, the principal dealt with it. But any, you know, in the last 30 years, the involvement of school resource officers in the schools, but also just the notion that, for instance, Iowa passed a statute years ago that whenever a young person is arrested, or that it's required that be told to the school. So then the school decides that they need to do something. And I guess the effect is really that for kids in more impoverished backgrounds and kids that are in communities of color, the process tends to drive them into the criminal justice system with all of the ramifications that that has in terms of affecting their ability to stay in school and get the education they need to be able to maybe to go on to college, the effect it has on their ability to get a job when they get done with school. So there's a whole bunch of things that go on there, and I think what we need is a recognition that this is something we need to talk about instead of having people deny that. It may not be solely about race, but it's about a lot of things, and there needs to be a more vibrant discussion about that.
Arnold, can you weigh in on the problem from your perspective?
Yes, the things that Ben mentioned are absolutely correct. We see patterns that are detrimental to us with incarceration trends in America, and in Iowa, especially racial disparities with incarceration. We see drug sentencing disparities, and there are contributing factors to that, of course, and we also see the effects of incarceration in some of the laws. And the question is Jim Crow still alive in Iowa and across the country? And the answer is yes, except it's taken on a new perspective now. Now we call it James Crow Esquire. So a lot of things that are happening within our system are overt rather than covert, and we find that laws are now being passed that penalize people who are of a different persuasion and don't think like the norm.
So what are some of the institutional problems that are creating this school-to-prison pipeline that we could address in our high schools?
Well, certainly in our high schools, and I would give some props to some of the things we're doing in our local community with racial profiling and other profiling. We're working in conjunction with Amos to document cases of racial profiling to better understand the problems that exist in our area, and we track those problems and try to help experience this from the form of discrimination to work to stop any type of profiling that presents itself. That's one thing that we're doing. We also look at the school system, and we understand the school system. Most of the issues with high schools are behavioral issues, and the different perspectives from different ethnic backgrounds present a problem for our school system. I know they do the best that they can, but we've determined that there's something that can be done about that. So we're working with middle school kids to do mediation. We've had mediation training to try to go into school and intervene to keep students out of the juvenile system. It's difficult once you get into the juvenile system to get out. We're also about expunging records for juveniles once they reach the age of 19 or 20 so that their record will not follow them throughout their college career and even beyond into employment. We recognize that oftentimes that when students apply to college, they're looking at their background, they're looking at what have they done as far as misdemeanors and how were they treated in high school, and it can be detrimental to the admissions process. So there are things like that we are certainly aware of.
Well, and we have, with violence in schools around the country, we have put a focus on security in our schools. By bringing officers into our schools, sometimes problems that would have been handled within the school disciplinary rules now become something that has happened or that is handled by an actual police officer, and it becomes something that goes beyond the boundaries of the schools. Has this created, do you think, an unfair problem for minority students in our high schools?
Once again, I think as we look at what's happening in our society today, especially with our young men and women, our young men and women of color, we look at the factors that contribute to crime and are the subject of crime is that the inner city crime is prompted by social and economic isolation. We look at the unemployment rate for young African Americans, which is double and even triple the national average of their counterparts. We look at the drug rates and the drug arrests, and African Americans represent about 12% of the the monthly drug users, but they can comprise 32% of the persons who are arrested for drug possession. So there's this disparity in what things are going on. We often see this get tough on drug and drug wars, and you know, mandatory sentences have a disparity for our youngsters and even those who are guilty, and the disparity between sentencing for crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. So there's a number of issues that are happening in our community that are stereotyped and are not necessarily true, and it's used against our youngsters in a lot of instances.
Before we move on to the war on drugs, Ben, I want to ask you about having school resource officers, having officers in our schools. Has that changed school discipline in a way that is unfair to minority students?
Well, I think that what it has done is, you know, first of all, I think that, you know, when you look at the school violence and the very high profile, the really terrifying incidents of you know, guns in the schools and mass shootings and killings, you know, I think school resource officers are largely in larger schools in the urban areas. They're going to be there. What we've really tried to focus on is, you know, first of all, not necessarily expanding their use, but also just better training. And I think that there's a broader discussion within the education and law enforcement community that we need to find ways to better train and put emphasis on not necessarily just, you know, grabbing that kid from the hallway in the high school and taking him down to juvenile. You know, there are other ways to deal with conflict. There are ways to create, more restorative justice strategies, because it's really demonstrated that when you take a kid and you suspend them or you kick him out of school, it really doesn't make that student all of a sudden become a better student who gets better grades and is going to graduate. It just accelerates their kind of disconnect from the school system and from the community, and we need to find ways to really focus on whoever is doing the discipline in the schools, thinking about what really is going to be a creative way to make better outcomes for everybody, including the student and society in general.
You mentioned three main problems in the beginning of our conversation, and we've been talking about this so-called school-to-prison pipeline. Racial profiling in the community has also come up. Is that something that you feel is a serious problem in Iowa communities?
Yes. Yes, it is. Certainly wherever there are significant numbers of African Americans and other people of color, you know, you just talk to the people that live there. And I think one of the things that's really been a struggle for everybody dealing with this is that it's often recognized that it exists other places, but we don't admit that it exists here. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, the NAACP and Amos are doing, is to try to document that it exists. But when the law enforcement community in a given city, whether it's in Des Moines or Chicago or Atlanta or wherever, there's a very difficult thing to overcome, which is that, you know, an admission that it's a problem. And it may be more complex than simply looking at someone's skin color, but there needs to be a more in-depth discussion and a recognition that we need strategies to make this problem go away, because a denial that it's a problem just tells everybody in that community of color that they're being dismissed and that they're not taken seriously, and that doesn't help anybody.
I know that our incarceration rate for people of color is proportionally much higher than it is for Caucasians in the state of Iowa. This is something that we see around the nation. I wonder, right at the start, we talked about the difference between overt racism and the kind of racism that you don't notice and that you don't see as clearly. Where do you think these problems are proliferating, that the kind of racism that we don't point out as racism, we can't identify that easily, Ben?
Well, you know, that's about a week-long program. I think that a lot of it is people getting comfortable not talking about it. And, you know, you're sitting around the Thanksgiving table and nobody wants to bring it up. And so that's part of it, is just that finding a way to use that very small conversational moment to help bring people along to thinking that we're all in this together, and we need to be thinking about one another in a very gracious and compassionate way, instead of just resenting one another and trying to find ways to blame other people. And so I think that, that's part of it. You know, people in power need to be willing to acknowledge that there are problems and find a way to have an honest discussion about it, both with people in a position to make changes and in the people that are being affected by those practices.
I feel that a lot of people talk their way around this issue in conversations. I'll hear people, even in discussions about diversity in schools, for example. Of course, the focus is on the percentage of students with free and reduced lunch. And in those conversations, as they continue, you start to hear other kinds of euphemisms, such as, well, there are those students from the people who came in from Chicago. And you realize that, maybe there is a racial bias at the root of this conversation. Is there a lot of this that we are talking our way around and just ignoring?
I noted that I went to a school board hearing recently here in Des Moines and determined that our school system now is 54% people of color. I also learned that there's 110 different languages spoken in our system, with Hoover High School having the most languages, but 37 different languages spoken at that high school. So this tells us that our population is changing. Not only are there Hispanics, but there are also people speaking Arabic, Swahili, Vietnamese, Somalia. So we have people from all over the world now in Iowa, and especially in Des Moines, which is a melting pot, which is a good thing. So, yeah, there's things that will have to change to address the issues. Now, in fact, I understand that one in four of the second through fourth graders speak a different language other than English as their primary language in their home. So, yes, there's many things that are changing locally that we need to deal with. The school system is trying to address those issues, of course. But part of our problems as we progress the next 10 to 15 years is then understanding that our population is going to change. So we have to be ready for it. We have to have diverse ideas and issues that we deal with to make this place called Des Moines a great place to live, work, and play, including the state of Iowa.
Arnold Woods, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Arnold Woods is president of the NAACP Des Moines branch. And Ben Stone, thank you.
Happy to be with you today.
Ben Stone is executive director of the ACLU of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. The program is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. I'm on Twitter at Charity Nebbe. We'd love to hear from you. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.